basketball, a game of giants. And there's number 99, George Mikan, one of the greatest.
Perhaps the most complete player the game has ever seen. The Lakers captain, Elgin Baylor.
2 seconds, 1 second. West throws it up.
Jerry West made it from the other side of the mid-point stripe.
Ford sends it to Kareem. Sky hook up and good. Lakers win.
Magic down the middle, just what I thought. A hook shot at 12. Good!
Shaquille fade away.
Giants for the win. James puts up the three. Oh, it's good!
Doncic on the drive. Step back. Puts it up. Puts it in! With 5 tenths of a second remaining!
What's up, Laker fans? You're listening to the Laker Film Room Podcast. I'm Pete, joined by Darius, and today we talk trades. For the Lakers offseason, I think there are basically two main types of players that they're trying to acquire. One is the starting center, which we've done a pod on and is a topic that we're going to revisit soon with some of the same names, but a couple of new ones as well. Just kind of check in on that. I definitely think that's very high on the Lakers' priority list. But I also think that the Lakers are looking to add a player who can put the ball in the hoop, D. Somebody at like an 18 to 20 plus point type of rate. And there are a couple of data points beyond just talking hoops with different people with the Lakers over the years and kind of having a gauge of what they prioritize and how they think that suggests to me that the type of player that they're looking for to fill that role is somebody that does not necessarily need the ball in their hands all that often to be able to put that 18, 20 plus points per game up on the board, which makes sense when you've got Luka Doncic and Austin Reeves as sort of the start of that type of team, that having a third ball handler, of which, you know, Giannis, you and I have talked Paolo a little bit behind the scenes, and those type of players do need the ball in their hands. And that's something that LeBron needed as well. And the Lakers viewing things this way, I want to just offer a couple of things on that front. When they did their postseason press conference between Rob and Redick, Pelinka made sure to bring up that the Lakers had sort of a three quarterback type of setup, and that's a luxury, having three guys that can run the offense in that way. It is also, if you're looking at it through a different lens, something is a bit of a crowded situation, that if the Lakers had their druthers, and I think we saw this when LeBron was out, they really went more toward as much spacing as they could get as possible. And so between that, I know this is reductive, but both Redick and Pelinka as basketball players, high-level basketball players, were shooters themselves. I think they really value this, D. And so we've talked a good deal about that, you know, potential LeBron replacement, which he's the guy that was the third player who was putting up 20 plus per game that filled this role. And I'm curious your thoughts on that, D, of we've focused a lot on a front court type of player, but what do you think of somebody that can really shoot the ball, right? That kind of an off ball shooter that can open up the offense. And Pelinka brought up the addition of Kennard and how that was sort of a proof of concept for the Lakers. It's got me thinking on this line, and there are a couple of names we'll talk about in a bit, but just more generally, D, what do you think of this idea?
I think the Lakers would love to have more shooting. I think all 30 teams in the NBA would love to have as much shooting as possible. I would say, though, that for the Lakers specifically, the slotting of a high-level hybrid usage sort of player, and I think that this is like a distinction between what Kennard was thought to be and like some of what Kennard ended up being through attrition of injury and how he got forced into more of a role where he had to absorb usage. I actually think the Lakers would love to have a higher version of that player.
That's what I'm saying. I think that, especially if you were a little taller and had some defensive utility. Yeah.
Yes, which is a very good player, not the sort of player that comes around very often. The ability to slot between Luka and Austin, or even complement both. I actually think it's a bit reductive to look at Luka and Austin only as these high usage on-ball players. I think one of the things the Lakers want to do as well is to find usage in other avenues of offensive creation that could allow Luka and Austin to explore all the facets of their games, including like Austin handling the ball and Luka working as an off-ball guy who like comes off double drags and curls into the lane, or not always just being Luka high ball screen or even Luka post-up threat. a guy who could spot up weak side, who could be a second side creator, who could come off of screens as an off-ball worker. I think they'd love to do the same thing for Austin, where he's utilized as a cutter and a movement player.
Doesn't LeBron facilitate that, though, as a guy who can you can give the ball to, and then you move that, those guys into those roles, and you've got one of the great decision makers of all time?
He does, and I think that's what the Lakers did this past offseason. The point that I was going to get to with all of this is that a player who can work as an off-ball worker, right, who you run actions for as a movement player, who could then also like maybe run a ball screen every now and then, or be a spot-up player himself, be a player who like cuts weak side, or who comes off screens not just to shoot, but to like curl into the lane, or leverages his own gravity to be able to back cut and then like finish at the basket, right? There's all of these things that you could then put into your offense that help optimize Luka and Austin as well. This symbiotic relationship between, I think, high-level on-ball players, which Luka is obviously one of the best in the world at, and Austin, who is more of a hybrid player but has been thrust more into an on-ball role and can do that very well, and an off-ball player who draws attention away from on-ball usage players in ways where it's just like, oh my goodness, this guy is requiring more defensive of attention that then mitigates all of the eyeballs that would be on your best player who has the ball a lot.
Really, to hammer home this point, one thing that I see a decent amount is like, oh, if the Lakers would only run something on the weak side as they're running a ball screen on the strong side, it'll occupy the defense, free things up for Luka, which sounds great until it's Gabe Vincent that's the guy who's coming off the screen, or you're setting a screen for Jake LaRavia. You've got to have a threat out there for the defense to care. Otherwise, you're actually sort of cluttering things up. The type of guy you're talking about and we're talking about presents that dilemma for a defense where it's if you don't pay attention to that guy, he could really burn you.
I would even argue, Pete, a player like Rui, who is not as much of a movement shooter, who is not someone who you run a ton of action for off of the ball, that even he, as like a standstill player or a guy who either is spotting up or cutting right to the basket in order to finish, that there is a certain amount of understanding from the defense of, I know where you're going to be. I remember two seasons ago when the Lakers played the Timberwolves in the playoffs, one of the things that they did to Rui was, we're totally taking away that baseline cut that you ate on during the regular season. And Rui ended up becoming only a jump shooter, right? And he can make you pay only as a jump shooter, but if it's only going to be on swing or skip pass or pick and roll, sort of like, okay, the dive man is requiring a tag and now the one pass away kick out is coming to you, he can make the defense pay that way. Oh, you're helping off of Rui from nail help and the ball just goes to him. He will make you pay for sure, but the guys who move around and come off of screens and it's just like, can just 1-2 step going into their jumper and like really almost falling down as they shoot. There's a whole nother level of value that comes from that sort of player that requires way more defensive attention. And so the point that you were making is like, oh, okay, well, here's Jake LaRavia setting a back screen for Gabe Vincent, or here's Jared Vanderbilt cutting and screening. It's just like, yeah, you can create meaningful movement that way, but the defense, especially a playoff level defense, is going to be like, all right, bro, go off.
Yeah, prove that you can make these shots and be an offensive threat. And so this is the total other end of the spectrum. I'm so glad you brought up Rui, since we've been talking about him the last couple of days. Let's go to an early break here and come back and talk about him in this context. So yeah, we're sitting here talking about, yeah, Lakers adding a third offensive player, a shooter, a scorer. What if we had a forward who can shoot after we spent the last two pods talking about Rui, right? You were talking about this type of player providing a level of value that's beyond that. It's to me, the value is in the volume, is that if you can't do some yes. of those things, and the dribbling and ball handling component is a big part of this as well, that if you can't create for yourself a little bit off of the dribble, it knocks down the number of threes that you can take. And so part of Rui's value as this hyper-efficient three-point shooter is reduced a bit by the fact that he just doesn't take that many of them. And when we go into a playoff series, you'll see opponents put smaller defenders. We saw Houston have some success with putting Reed Shepard on him, or Cason Wallace had some reps on him as well, where they know that they can stay in front of him and he can't really get to the basket from that spot because he doesn't have the handles. That, to me, is like the values and the volume.
In the Timberwolves series that I cited, Mike Conley was on him a little bit as well. And so we've talked about in years past, particularly when Anthony Davis was still on the team, that the value of Rui being slotted next to LeBron and Anthony Davis was that you run out of front court guys and Rui ends up being able to benefit from having a smaller player on him and the duck-ins and all of that. But when you get to the playoffs, a lot of that stuff gets reduced to such a degree that you're not going to scheme and game plan your way around this idea of a Rui duck-in against a point guard.
Right. And Rui's like pretty stiff on his finishes around the rim. That's not something that is super natural for him. And so in that context, like a shooter who can rack a closeout and sort of has a little bit of bendiness to them and finishing ability that isn't quite as rigid as Rui's.
This comes off as us bashing Rui, and I don't want that to be the case. It's just that he is a more limited archetype in terms of a shooter and like the volume.
Yeah, he's
stuff.
The same type of player, right? He's just, we're talking about like sort of a higher level player of similar type of guy, yeah.
Rui is much more of a, when his feet are square and when he is truly in a spot-up situation, I expect that shot to go in every time.
Yes.
Even if he only makes 38% of them and he makes more than those, when he takes a clean look, I think it's going in. And during the playoffs, it went in like half the time. And so that really does make you feel confident. There's plenty of nights where Rui's 2-for-5 or 3-for-6. And it's just like, man, he had a good shooting night. He hit half of his threes. Mm-hmm. The type of player that we're talking about is you can get up 13 threes or 14 threes and not do it because the other team ignored you, right? So like Alex Caruso had some games in the Western Conference Finals, particularly that game one against the Spurs, where the game plan was like, we're ignoring you. We don't care how many of these shots that you take. And Alex Caruso was just like, word, you don't care how many I take? How about I take 16 of them and I make 9? Oh, well, do we have to sort of retrofit our game plan to this idea that you're going to be a high volume 3-point shooter? That comes totally off of the defense's decision to say, no, 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 no. Take 20 of these. We don't care, right? You're literally going to have to make 15 before we actually change up. The sort of player that we're talking about can get you 12 based off the fact that he's just moving around and zipping around the court, or is so big and agile that it's difficult to just track him around the court based off of the type of defender that has to guard him.
So who are these mythical beasts that we're talking about? There are two guys that come to mind that I think are to some degree on the trade market and fit this archetype. That's Lauri Markkanen and Trey Murphy III. I want to start with Markkanen. Markkanen might at this point be the best off-ball scorer in the NBA. Like, I think he averaged like 27 a game last year. Very efficient. He's a lob threat. Somebody that does move off of screens, can pull up from mid-range, can handle for his size. He's about 7 feet tall. And that's part of the reason why I think he's available, D, is, you know, we've been talking about Utah traded for their power forward. They're likely to bring back Kessler. Markkanen is most certainly not a center. And as soon as those two are drafted, and then you're starting to hear, you know, Utah likes Cam Boozer. They've long been rumored to be in on AJ DeBanza, that you kind of run out of spots for Lauri Markkanen. Now, I am less enthusiastic about him due to the size of his contract, which we'll get into, but let's put that aside just for now. Deeds, what do you think of Markkanen as a player?
He's an incredible offensive talent. His production can wax and wane a little bit. You're right, though. Last year, he averaged 26.7 points a game. He only shot 35.5% from three. And the year before that, he was only at 34.6%. But that was after back-to-back seasons where he shot 39.1 and then basically 40%, 39.9. And it's the volume idea from three that we were just discussing, Pete. Here's his last four seasons in terms of attempts per game from behind the arc: 7.7, 8.0, 8.5, and last year he was at 7.7 again. So his floor as a volume player, particularly as a guy who the offense is sort of built around, which wouldn't necessarily be the case with the Lakers.
But he also isn't going to be set up in Utah or those other places. Like, imagine Luka Doncic passing that dude the ball.
That's exactly where I was going with this, is that there's a floor of volume and in utility in the in how he takes his threes that is important. We talked about this some last year when the Lakers were playing the Jazz and Markkanen was actually in the lineup, because Utah has been full of chicanery the last 3 or 4 years in terms of who plays when and what games they sit and everything else. But the Jazz and Will Hardy often used Markkanen like a 7-foot Steph Curry. They had him setting back screens. They had him coming off of double drag screens, or like the guy who was setting back picks in Spain action and just doing a lot of stuff where you're a movement shooter.
That's what we were doing with Kennard, right? Like, people would lament that he's not taking enough threes out of those, but he was helping us get into the blender. That's basically what they do with Markkanen, except he's 7 feet tall.
Yeah, and the fact that he is 7 feet tall means that one of the reasons why Kennard doesn't get up as many threes is that his release, he doesn't want to rush his release. Like, he can if he's up against the shot clock or whatever, but he'd much prefer to be a more deliberate shooter. And Markkanen is much more of a quick trigger shooter, and he's also 7 feet tall. And so the ability to contest his shot, this is why I'm saying that the volume, he has a floor of volume to me just because he's so big. He can get off this shot whenever he wants, and his game is geared toward that. It's not like Wemby. Wemby could take 15 threes a game if he wanted, because he could just shoot over the top of anyone at any time. Same with Kevin Durant. But they actually didn't want their game to be so three-point centric. Markkanen has sort of come up as a shooter in a way where the rest of his game is predicated off of him being a threat from out there. So even in seasons where he's shooting 35% from three, he's still able to get you 20 plus points a night based off the idea. It's just like, well, no, you have to close out to me, or you have to like monitor me. And when I'm coming off screens, you might jump out at me with a bigger player, that it opens things up within the offense, that he's truly an elite, elite offensive player. Idea within a larger context, and you surround him with players like Luka and Austin, I think he would eat even more and open things up for Luka and Austin in ways that are truly helpful to them, pick and pops and all kinds of other stuff that you could do.
Yeah, I think we'd have a dominant offense at that point if you had that. However, the arguments against are the defense and the contract. Can you really build a championship team with your highest paid players being Luka, Markkanen, and Austin? That's a lot of money, and not a single guy that's better on the defensive end than the offensive end. And that leads to the contract. Markkanen's owed $46 million next year, which, for a guy who's scoring near the upper echelons of the league on a bad team, for sure, but it's not crazy out of place or anything like that. It's just, you've devoted so many of your resources. You don't have defense, and it's probably going to take a little bit to get him, although I do think Utah kind of needs to get off his contract. I don't know if you've got enough to be able to build a team. Even if you're just starting from those three guys, those three are going to be on the floor to close the game. Can you win a championship like that? I don't think so.
Yeah, I think that you'd be hard pressed to say that team is going to be good enough on defense. You would need a dominant level center, honestly, or another sort of dominant level forward,
right,
who could help facilitate small ball groups in ways that would allow your team to be, we're a top five offense and top two or three, honestly, offense.
Yeah, no, they'd have to be great. Yeah.
And we can scrap together enough size and versatility defensively that in the most leverage of moments, we could get the stops that we need. That would ultimately be the formula. I think that it would likely be way more of a regular season success team than a playoff success team. That said, Luka has typically been a guy who could outpace playoff defenses in a way that it allows you to be a good playoff team too in some ways.
No, 100%. I think that, you know, a lot of times we can undervalue offense in the playoffs and just the ability to make shots and make tough shots. That's what Markkanen does, right? And so certainly don't write that off. But I do think the contract is a bit prohibitive with his weaknesses, despite, you know, having some length.
I would also say too, Pete, that Danny Ainge and Austin Ainge, but Danny Ainge especially, is not in the business of just giving guys away.
Uh-huh.
He's not. And even if they were to say, oh yeah, well, we're drafting Cam Boozer number two overall because DeBanta went number one. And now we're sort of log jammed in our front court. They traded for Jaren Jackson. They want to retain Walker Kessler. They just drafted Cam Boozer. They have Markkanen. They have Ace Bailey, who in a lot of ways is like also mm-hmm. a small forward, mm-hmm. right? And who you may have to play out of position at shooting guard some just to get him on the court. And so you've got a ton of players. Ainge is still going to be like, yeah, we've got a guy who averaged 25 plus points per game. We're not giving him away for salary cap space.
Totally. Especially to the freaking Lakers, right? Like, that's one of our hated rivals of all time. Let's go to break here. I want to come back, wrap up this discussion on Markkanen, and then talk some Trey Murphy. On that front, D, in terms of acquiring him, I think there is some utility to Utah in getting a large trade exception, because I think the talent that they're going to need going forward with Keontae George, who's eligible for an extension this year, they just drafted Ace Bailey as well, who's got more of an offensive tilt to his game, super talented kid for sure. They need perimeter defenders. Like, they need some two-way guys that I think it will be difficult for them to be like, we've got Lauri Markkanen, who makes $46 million, and what we need are three role players that we like from a team that also likes Lauri Markkanen. In some ways, a traded player exception gives a team like that a degree of cash to spend. Now, they'd have to have those deals set up for it to make sense, right? You don't want to be stabbing in the dark in that respect, but the ability to go like, hey, you know, Cam Johnson would be helpful here and isn't going to cost a lot. We can take him off of Denver's hands and he could be useful to us. Lou Dort in OKC, same type of thing, where I think they could get the type of talent that they need on their team, which is more of that two-way type of talent that I think they could figure something out between those parties. But ultimately, I don't think it's in the Lakers' best interest.
Yeah, a three-way trade between Utah, the Lakers, and Denver actually makes a ton of sense.
Exactly.
If you actually wanted marketing, right?
Right.
Like, if Denver wants to keep Peyton Watson, they could easily say, hey, Utah, do you want another Caucasian player? And you could have Christian Brown in your backcourt next to Keontae George, and then they still get a trade exception from the Lakers. The Lakers get Markkanen and yada, yada, yada. Like, I'm intrigued by this idea of Markkanen in general, just because I think that he helps make you awesome on offense. I would just want a very specific, like, high-level center. Like, I almost feel like you need Kessler with him or
yeah,
something
you,
like
you
that.
Yeah, you need,
right?
Like, the other two guys. And I don't even really think that defense works this way. I've seen plenty of really good defenses be sort of laid to waste because they just made the one or two bad defenders in the lineup, the main characters, the other team did over and over again. So I don't think it's something like, oh, we've got these three iffy defenders, but our other two guys are Hall of Fame caliber defenders in these other spots that are going to save the day. I just don't really think it works that way in the first place. Let's move on to Trey Murphy III, though, D. Murphy is intriguing in part because he makes $27 million next year. And so the point we were just talking about is an important one for this Lakers team in that there is no, we trade for this one guy that put 20 points on the board and now we're contending for the championship. We've got other needs on the team, specifically that spot. And so it's important to be able to address that while having resources left over to be able to pursue that. I actually think that the Pelicans, if I had to pick like a number one team that I would guess the Lakers would make a trade with, and this is a low percentage with any individual team, but it'd be the Pelicans. I think there are a lot of guys on their team that we'd have some degree of interest in, and Dumars would have some level of motivation in moving. Now, with Murphy, he is a similar type of player, gets up that volume of, you know, I think 8 threes per game for them. He had some reps this year as an on-ball guy that I don't think he was very good at them. I don't think he's a particularly good passer. He misses a decent number of reads, or a particularly good dribbler. for a number one or on ball type of guy. However, for a shooter, since he's got those reps in it, for a guy that if his main role is as an off ball shooter, that you can also give him the ball. You talk a lot about second side action where you run a play, the thing on the strong side isn't open, but something on the weak side is. You skip it over to that guy. Well, can that guy dribble? Can that guy be a threat off of a pick and roll, for example? Murphy can absolutely do that type of stuff. He averaged a steal and a half per game. He's got a good degree of length. I've always noticed him in a negative way on defense. I do have a blanket coverall. If you're on a bad team, bad franchise, I give you a little bit of slack. Like PJ Washington, for example, a couple of years ago was, oh, he's on the Hornets. He doesn't defend. He's not that great of a shooter. But, you know, you put him in a competitive environment with some stakes on the line and something to play for. All of a sudden, hey, this guy's really getting in the stance and doing what he needs to do. So what are your thoughts on Trey Murphy III?
Murphy's an interesting player to me in that, you know how we sort of badmouthed Herb Jones like a few
times. I'm sorry, that was me. Yeah.
Well, it's like, you didn't hear me rebutting a bunch when it came to that stuff. Murphy's a guy where, A, he kills the Lakers a fair amount. And so, like, if there's a fan base that's attuned to how good Trey Murphy can be, it's Lakers fans for sure who are just like, wait, how did the Lakers let him shake free for his eighth three-pointer this game or something crazy, right? Like, he's done a fair amount of that over his career to the Lakers. He is a toolsy guy when it comes to defense who doesn't leverage his tools. Like, he reminds me in some ways of Brandon Ingram in that way, where it's just like, bro, how are you going to be so tall and long and be this athletic, but like not impact the game defensively at all?
My one pushback on that is he was 11th in steals this year, had 1.5 steals per game. He had like 0.7, 0.8 blocks last year. Like he does it more than B.I. B.I. would drive me crazy with that. Like if you look at B.I.'s stock numbers, it's like, this is inexcusable. It's not quite that bad.
Fair. That's fair. The sort of like sitting high in his stance and is he getting after it? That sort of stuff does stand out to me with Murphy. To your point, though, in terms of like the Markkanen style of player, here's his last three seasons of three-point attempts. 7.8, 8.3 in last year, 8.6 attempts per game. And those percentages were 38, 36.1, and last year, basically 38 again, 37.9%. That's high volume, and the types of threes he's hitting too are like, he's a guy who can shoot the four-pointer. You hear that referred to a fair amount, but he's a guy that could take the deep three.
And this is really important for spacing when you've got a couple of drivers, by the way. That really opens things up.
And so Murphy's ability to spot up well behind the arc and then also be a transition player and a finisher when he gets into the paint because he's such a high flyer. It's an interesting combination. He's very used to also being an off-ball worker. Like, I know we talked about, or you mentioned that he got more opportunities in the last, like, season and a half or so. But in reality, Pete, his teammates have been Zion and CJ McCollum and DeJounte Murray and
many of whom haven't played barely at all. Yeah.
Yes, but they are guys who we're giving the ball to these guys instead.
Yes.
Right? And Murphy's had to be a guy who is like second or third in the pecking order in terms of on-ball work and has often been a guy who's the ball is coming to him for him to make something happen rather than him starting a possession with the ball in order to make something happen. And those are the sorts of players within this framework that we're discussing with him and Markkanen that I think have real value when your best player is Luka. Mm-hmm. Like putting Austin to the side, even just having a player like Murphy who could be a second side guy who you could put in weak side corner or in the slot, there's great value in having that type of guy there. And the sort of toolsy aspect of his defense does intrigue me in the same way that you brought up Washington from now with the Mavs. But in his time with Charlotte, it was just like, oh man, you're freaking 6'10 and rangy. Like, what's going on with you? And that's Murphy as well. He's tall.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's not 6'6". He's listed at 6'8". And having a guy that big and that rangy also opens up a bunch of, like, defensive versatility for you if you can play in, like, small ball groups and stuff like that. And so Murphy's a guy that's super intriguing to me. He's also a guy that, like, almost every contender is seemingly making calls to New Orleans, like, how can I get Trey Murphy, right? Mm-hmm. And Joe Dumars has sort of been hoarding his players in this way where it's just like they don't want to make deals, seemingly.
Sure.
Like, so I'm wondering what it would cost to get him, mm-hmm. what's the investment in that and everything else. And so I'm actually more into this idea than the Markkanen idea in a lot of ways, because he makes basically half of what Markkanen does. But getting him may cost a lot more, mm-hmm. based off of just the competition for him specifically.
It might. And so it goes to what is New Orleans looking for and what is Joe Dumars looking for? I saw a report this morning, and all of these take these with a grain of salt, but that, you know, they're looking to make a move. If they were to move Murphy, they would want to make their team better in the short term. Now, he's a good player. Trading good players away takes you farther from that goal. But it also speaks to a level, if that report is true, of picks might not be the main thing that it's like, oh, trade Murphy for two picks or three first rounders or anything like that. That I don't really think that's what New Orleans, they've been in that game and in that space for years now, and they're looking to improve their team. They also had Sadiq Bey, I thought, had a really good breakout year for them this season, that plays about the same position that Murphy does, that is coming up on the last year of his contract. They signed him right after he tore his Achilles, I believe it was, or
ACL.
Thank you.
It was ACL, mm-hmm. yeah.
And so Bey was a prospect and somebody that the Lakers have liked for a couple of years, that they were able to get him on a 3-year deal where it was like, basically, we'll pay you $7 million this year to recover. In the second year, we think we're going to have a better player than a $7 million player, and they did. And then they're going to have that player for a third year, this upcoming year. But I think that there's a decent chance they would want him to slot into that type of role. You got Herb Jones there too. DeJounte Murray is healthy. Several of these guys I don't expect to be with them, but I do see a path toward them being able to move Murphy and improve as a team. So with the Lakers, what would that look like? I think that that's a great spot for, again, the usage of the cap space that the Lakers have, meaning that, okay, let's play out the same scenario as we did with Utah. If they could get guys like Johnson, guys like Dort, into those spots to replace Murphy with more defensive-minded type of perimeter talent, that I could see them looking for a similar type of trade that we just sort of game-planned out for Utah, where they convert him into good two-way players, but less your 20-point-per-game type of guys.
Yeah, that same idea of just like, again, like I'll bring up Christian Brown as an idea here, or even Cam Johnson. Like, those are players who can slot in exactly to, like, a role with a team like the Pelicans. I actually think Denver is a prime candidate to also make a deal in this way, where Denver is the team that ends up with the salary relief.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we've talked about multiple teams where it's just like, who are the teams that have to save money? And so go around the league, look at the teams that need to save money. Look at the players who make close to what Murphy makes, but do a different job, and then slot Murphy into the Lakers and slot that team that needs to save money into that trade exception idea. And you can come up with deals in a variety of ways, like, mm-hmm. go look at players on Orlando's roster, go look at players on Cleveland's roster, go look at, like,
yep.
go around the league and say, all right, well, would you want to trade Trey Murphy for Christian Brown? Would you want to trade him for, I don't know, man, Jalen Suggs, or, like, right?
Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think, by the way, Christian Brown's going to have a particularly hot market. I think they're like, he's a negative contract in his own right.
I agree on that. And I wouldn't necessarily want Brown for the Lakers.
No.
Like, he's just starting his extension. He was hurt a fair amount last year. His two previous seasons, he was mostly good and is a good athlete who competes hard defensively. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you on, like, the negative asset idea with him. It's also one of those things where he makes, like, what is it, 22 or 25
yeah,
a year?
Yeah, something like it's, that, yeah.
Anyways. My point is that there are ways to sort of conjure up
yes.
3 in or even 4 team deals, right? And the summer is the time to make trades.
Yes.
Like that. And there's a reason why we're having dialogue like this now in the off season rather than having dialogue like this in January, in the month that leads up to the trade deadline, because there's so much more flexibility that the Lakers are going to have now. And these are the sorts of avenues they should be exploring as far down the road as they can get with any of them to try to improve their roster.
Very much so. And to put a closing thought on Murphy, I still have the I don't know if you can have enough defense on the floor between the three of those guys, too. Same thing that we were saying with Markkanen. I do think that having the extra money, about a $20 million difference in the salary that Murphy makes versus Markkanen, allows you to get better players, can help patch holes elsewhere. But the same argument of can you have these three guys on the floor in a championship type of series, I still have those same questions. But it's been really fun to talk this out with you, D. We've got game 4 of the finals tonight. We'll talk about that tomorrow and get into a little bit more of the Lakers offseason. I don't think people realize we're like 2 weeks away, and really we're less than a month away from probably knowing what the team's going to be next year or very close to it. But we'll be back tomorrow, talk more Lakers offseason. But until then, you've been listening to Laker Film Room Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
Baines has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn, he's double teamed. Just pass out of front, broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
There's Magic got it. Magic fires. It's good. And the Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game. Rebound is Lowry. 3 seconds left. Van Exel the winner. It's on the way.
Kobe Bryant, 48 points, 16 rebounds. Shaq with his 8th block shot that ties an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
right, in Boston.
In Boston.
Of all places.
Are you kidding me?
Kobe, hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal. Are you kidding me?
Lakers looking to push. Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Freddie pass. And it's back to a 3-point game.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell.
There's the move. 2-1.
Miss it.
Bryant. Unbelievable. For the victory. It's over.
Shot clock now to 5. Bryant.
Yeah. And that was a little tap to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?
2.1 seconds remaining. Denver a foul to give. Jokic trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis. 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good. Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers. James again. Oh, he hits another one. LeBron James putting together a closing quarter against the Nuggets.
This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.